HUD and the Ad Council.
Here at the GED Pep Talk Center, we've got a pep talk that can motivate you.
Sometimes things don't always turn out the way you want them to.
You can improve your future. Now get your game face on and take the first step towards a better life. Hurry up! Don't make me repeat myself.
Whatever level of motivation you need, we've got a pep talk for you. Call 1-877-38-YOUR-GED or visit yourged.org for your pep talk and for free classes in your area. GED is a registered trademark of the American Council on Education, brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
WebAdvisor, a program allowing students and staff access to college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, you are able to register for classes, view grades, track financial aid, print class schedules, and much more. Log into WebAdvisor by going to my.hfcc.edu/webadvisor or from the homepage hfcc.edu.
Hey, it's Brian from the Verve Pipe, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
And now, our Tuesday forum. We're going to happily present the debut of a new show that's actually produced by our friends at CIUT-FM 89.5 in Toronto, from the University of Toronto. And they call it The Green Majority.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
This is our world. We want to engage. We share this place. Let's take the front page. We are all the green majority. We are all the green majority.
All right, this is The Green Majority. You're listening to Darren Kaster's voice right now. And that was, of course, not Fortet. That was our amazing new theme song produced by the wonderful and talented Alejandra Rivera. We will have links to her stuff. But that is our new theme song. We will be hearing that every week. We have, unfortunately, as much as we loved it. And thank very much to Fortet for lending us, possibly without his knowledge, but under fair use, using his theme song. That was the retired song, of course, was Everything Is All Right by Fortet. We'll still be thanking him on the website, of course, for using his song until now. But we are now on our new theme song, which will allow us a little bit more freedom to post things and all sorts of other fun stuff. I also would like to announce that we do have the final version of our new logo, which will be going up with today's post. This also means that I have spoken to my friend Mark Haven, who's over at Repair the World, which is, of course, the clothing manufacturer. We've interviewed them on the show before. They made some shirts for us in the past that I gave away a couple of. I kept a couple. But it was based on our old design. I wasn't entirely happy with it, but there's nothing wrong with the shirts. It was my design, actually, that I wasn't happy with. So we had a couple of shirts printed, and we were going to start selling them. We weren't able to do that because I wasn't happy with my design. The shirts, of course, are made with recycled plastic bottles and cutting room floor scraps, so they are eco-friendly, and they also use safe inks and all sorts of stuff. But we now that we do have our new logo, what that means is that we're going to be able to start getting shirts. So we've started actually video recording the show. I have a camera on me right now. If you are watching this, you might find this very funny that I'm waving at my own camera. But there we go. We're just actually waiting for Kevin Varmer to slip in the studio here as well. But what we're going to be doing as well is I'm going to be ordering, I've actually already ordered one of the new shirts with the brand new logo, the logo that will be up with today's post as well. And I'm going to be wearing that on camera, so you can see one. If you like it, you can get one. I think our new logo is pretty freaking awesome, if I do say so myself. So big thanks to Ian Kant as well for putting that together for us as well. We'll be putting links up for him as well for all his works, for doing the logo for us and everything else. I've got Kevin Farmer slipping into the studio now. who is probably just about to realize that he has cameras on him for the first time ever. How you doing, Kevin?
Good morning, Darren.
You wore a nice shirt today. It's almost as if you'd known I was going to surprise you with video cameras today.
No, I had no idea. This is just luck of the draw.
Don't worry. I put them both on both of our good sides. I actually established what both our good sides were. So you'll be doing just fine. Kevin, today we've got a few things going on. I know you've got a few stories you wanted. The feature we're going to be doing today, just one, will actually be with Andrea Reeks and Corey Gould, who are both from Patagonia, which is a sustainable clothing manufacturer. There's one here in Toronto and a couple other stores as well. I believe one or two other ones in Canada, and then, if I'm not mistaken, one or two in the U.S. as well. But I have to just double-check that as well. But I do know they have a store in Toronto, and the store in Toronto, in addition to the other stores, will be doing Bike to Work Month events. So every Monday, they'll be having some stuff at their store. I believe they're actually making mixed smoothies with a bike-powered blender or something to that effect. as well, which should be a lot of fun. So I'm going to try and stop by any of those. That'll be every Monday in May. You'll hear that in the interview. We'll be getting to that in just a couple of moments. But in addition to that, also, I was contacted by the Water Brothers, our dear friends over at TVO, who are doing their amazing water TV show Sunday. And I was confused because I thought they'd said it was World Water Day. And I thought, now, wait a minute, we just had that. But no, June the 8th is actually World Oceans Day. Very important, because not all water is in oceans, although all oceans are water. Interesting fact. I don't know if you knew that. so we will have that. They're going to be doing some special stuff as well. I'll be announcing that later. But I thought in general, in addition to your headlines today, Kevin, that we would just talk about some fun water facts. So I went to National Geographic and I printed out a whole bunch of fun facts, some of them including such tantalizing headlines as study, marine species collapse, and they mean all of it, by 2048. Another one, world's largest dead zone, suffocating the sea. Overfishing adding to algal blooms. Too late to save the Baltic Sea. And it goes on. That's actually just two of about six pages of stories here that took, I'd say, less than 5 minutes to actually find. So I'd imagine we'd have quite a longer show if I actually spent a bit of time here, Kevin. But I know if the oceans are a bit of your bag, aren't they? So why don't, right off the top of your head, if you have any words for World Ocean Day.
Well, like you say, the sort of the projection of massive marine ecosystem failure by 2048 is actually not news. That's a datum that's been around for quite a while. The earliest I remember being alerted to how fragile the oceans had become was in 2005 when the UN published its Millennium Ecosystems Assessment, which is something you can find this online. Just Google Millennium Ecosystems Assessment and you'll find all manner of copies and summaries of it. And it's well worth reading. And it was described it started in 2000 and then 5 years later it was published. And it was described by the New York Times as an exhaustive inventory of Earth's life support mechanisms, which is a really apt description of what they were doing. And they basically set out to inventory the ecological health of the Earth. And so you don't undertake that unless you think there's a reason for it. Like you assume people are expecting bad news when they figure it's time to take Earth's temperature. And, and even for a group of people, excuse me, who were alert or attuned to the fact that they were going to be getting some bad news, they were appalled by what they discovered about Earth's oceans. The fragility of life in Earth's oceans they found to just be, they were so unprepared for it that they made, you know, special note of this in their report, that they were just unprepared for their findings about how fragile life in the oceans had become. And then, you know, a couple of years later, Mother Jones, which is an excellent publication that's often been very far ahead of the curve on environmental reporting, published just a huge article. It took up most of the magazine, that had been sponsored, I believe, by the Pew Charitable Trusts. That again was just a complete, if you can find, you know, you could probably find this article online again by Googling Mother Jones and oceans, and Pew maybe. But again, it was just, you know, not to go into too many details, but the outcome of that, article was essentially that life in the oceans is dying, we've mined the oceans into huge watery graves where you know, once vast ecosystems are teetering on the brink of utter extinction. And it's been out of sight, out of mind, and life on Earth can't proceed with no life in the oceans.
Well, so, you literally took the words right out of my mouth. I was just about to say out of sight, out of mind. I mean, when we're talking about the trawling of the ocean bottom, a lot of people don't really understand how a lot of fish farming is actually done.
Right.
But we're essentially taking the equivalent. This is like the equivalent of farming. Maybe you've gone to some nice trouble and you've gotten planted a lovely backyard garden. There's some flowers there, some nice grapes. You have some kale, cucumbers, whatever it is. And then when it's time to harvest, you take a shopping cart and you attach it to the back of your car and you stick it into the ground a couple of inches and then step on the gas on the car as a way of pulling out. Like, that's literally how that they're getting the fishes. They're dragging tons and tons of metal across the bottom of the ocean and literally strip mining it. It's strip not mining, a figure of
exactly,
speech. It's
yeah.
literally strip mining.
No, the marine biologists who go in after the fact and study the devastation are always on the verge of tears when they see what's happened to the ecosystems. Like, the corals are crushed, and every organism that depended on sort of clinging to rocks has been overturned, and then there's the notion of the bycatch. They pull up everything in sight, like they literally hoover that section.
Bycatch sounds like a nice friendly word, Kevin. What does
yeah,
that mean?
Yeah, so what it means is that they get what they once all of those nets are emptied out onto the boats, they throw away 75% of the catch as bycatch, because it wasn't, you know, they're grabbing everything. They're removing everything from the ecosystem, but only keeping what's marketable and throwing the rest back into the seas. Dead, of course, and now completely useless to everyone. And so this is strip mining is a good word for it, because it's sort of like a one-time thing. And the size of these ships would just blow your mind if you saw them. Like, they're ships that are factories. They're entire.
I was going to say, no, I think that's where my backyard sort of comparison breaks down, is at least the garden you could regrow something the next year. This is pretty much toast. It's a one-time deal.
Yeah, and we once believed that the Grand Banks fisheries were inexhaustible, and we've proven it. And then, despite the fact that the catches were dropping year by year and the quotas kept mysteriously going up year by year, somehow we brought that ecosystem to the brink of utter collapse and didn't learn a single freaking thing. And we've taken the same ideology that mined the Grand Banks fisheries into nothingness, and we've expanded it throughout the entire oceans, and literally people are unaware. This is, you know, like you say, this is a point I've been making for a few years now. People are just generally unaware that the oceans could go belly up in a few decades, and it's very hard to predict. It's very hard to see any positive outcomes for human civilization.
And I think it's sort of telling and sad unto itself, sort of how easily that rolls off of your tongue as well. Just saying, you know, all life in the ocean's dying by 24, you know, and it's just like, it's just, but I mean, it's sort of, you lose the emphasis, the difference between saying, you know, I think it has the same impact, unless you really sort of focus your mind on it. I think if just hearing those words has the same impact as saying there's a small, you know, variety of bacterium that only exists in a small portion of you know, Lake Superior, and unfortunately due to, you know, that's the only place it exists in the world, and unfortunately due to a chemical spill or something, we've wiped out this species. No, we're talking about wiping out millions of species.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, even hearing you say it, maybe it's just because I'm numb to it, but because we talk about it all the time, but I really don't think those words sink in. I think we have to repeat them a few times over.
Well,
for that, really, to all life in the oceans.
Yeah,
we're talking about the birthplace of life.
Yeah, I spend a significant amount of my time writing letters to politicians and news media, and that's why I'm numb to it, because none of them listen to me. I write letter after letter after letter, you know, citations and you know, published with quotes from world-renowned people, and I can't get these things published. Occasionally I get letters to the editor published, but I can't get sort of opinion pieces published or anything. I can't even get what I gather is, I just can't get journalists and editors to take seriously the fact that there's an environmental crisis. I think we've got a lot of journalists who are educated in journalism and they've never ever taken the time to do an environmental studies course or to.
Which, furthermore, I would say that the journalism training is these days more realized in the practice of, you know, always getting two sides of the story regardless of where the facts are. So I wouldn't even put too much credence in their journalism experience.
Yeah, or keeping training. Up with Justin Bieber's tweets and, you know, every possible guess as to what the gender of William and Kate's baby is going to be. And here's a spoiler alert, folks. It's going to be a boy or a girl. Now, can we please get the F over this? Like, why, you know, as soon as there's any hint as to the gender of that baby, it's headline grabbing. Mm-hmm. But you talk about the extinction of species on an inconceivable scale, and you can't even get anyone to take you seriously. It doesn't even get a mention. Not even a letter to the editor will get past that. But boy, should Justin Bieber tweet something, we're just all over that. That's corporate media for you, which is, you know, just as useless as a screen door on a submarine.
And I should say we should move on and just keep with the pace and get to our feature. But just before we're moving on, at the risk of throwing all journalists under the bus and sort of having people maybe thinking that we're saying, you know, we're the best journalists, I think we have a lot of area to improve. You know, there's a lot I think we can do to improve this show. And obviously we don't have an opportunity, Kevin and I, neither of us have an opportunity to do any or very close to any primary reporting that is actually going out and getting these stories. So mm-hmm. we are dependent on the media that exists. But it should just be said that there are a few people who are doing a good job and reserve kudos. You said Mother Jones does that.
Mother Jones is always
Grist is another one that has an amazing job. The Guardian in the UK
is
absolutely front of the pack as far as I'm concerned, as far as making environmental stories headline news on the regular news, not just in the small environment section. And Mike D'Souza here in Canada as an individual reporter who does a great job as well. We've talked to him a couple of times.
There's an online magazine called The Ecologist. Excuse me. It used to be available in print, but they went to an all online format a few years ago. But The Ecologist is excellent reading as well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention our friends over there at Alternatives Journal as well. So there is definitely people out there, but you sort of have to know who they are.
Oh no, that's why I was careful to call them the corporate media.
Yeah.
The people running the 6 o'clock news and the daily newspapers and the, you know, the people that are obsessed with, you know, Justin Bieber and the Senate scandal and.
Well, I may, and I've done it about, in the past year, I've done it about three times. I might have to do it again today, but there's that clip from that famous movie, News. Was it? I'm forgetting. News radio or something. The guy who was yelling is, "I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore." That clip. It's news. I'm forgetting the name of the film. It's news something. Anyway, I'm probably at this point. I've just convinced myself I'm going to post it again. But I think he nailed it. It's sort of like, okay, yeah, like you're hearing it, but you're sort of lulled into, you know, he's talking, part of the one of his lines from that is like, you know, we heard about, you know, there's 6 stabbings today, 7 shootings, and 13 murders, as if that's the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
Right. And anyway, I love that rant. Great, great. I've just decided I'm posting it again on the show. Anyway, without further ado, we could probably spend all day talking about ocean stuff. And we will. We're going to come back and talk about some of these specific studies that I was able to find. But for now, we will go to our first and only feature for today, actually, which is, again, Andrea Reeks and Corey Gould from Patagonia, Toronto, talking about their involvement with Bike to Work Month.
So everything from our design philosophy to how we run our stores and our mail order business goes back to considering the environment and the people that work for us and the people that we work with. So every decision we make, we go back and see what sort of an impact we have on the environment and what kind of an impact we have on the people that we work with and work for us, and then make decisions based on that. And we're constantly going back to the decisions that we make to figure out how we can do things better. And one of the answers that we got out of asking ourselves many questions on how we could do things better was creating 1% for the planet in conjunction with Blue Ribbon Flies, or fly fishing company out of the U.S. So our owner and founder, Yvonne Chouinard, partnered up with their owner and founder, whose name currently has escaped me, but they came up with the idea of taxing their businesses. It's an environmental tax, essentially. So whatever money we make during the year, we give back 1% of that to environmental organizations that are local to the stores and the company. So we do that in the form of providing environmental grants.
And does the beneficiaries of this, so it's not just Patagonia that does this, you now have other retailers that have taken, that are participating.
Oh, right? Yeah, there are several hundred businesses. Anywhere, they don't have to be retailers, any business at all. Individuals who are consultants, there's a lawyer here in Toronto that is part of 1% for the Planet, so 1% of everything he makes, he gives back to environmental organizations. So there's several hundreds. There's a website you can go to that I believe is just 1%fortheplanet.org.
Mm-hmm.
There's a list of businesses there.
Lawyers seem like a prime target market to get to raise lots of money. I would
actually, like, that'd be a substantial amount of grants for an environmental organization.
Absolutely. So tell me that. I mean, that would be, I think, my logical next question. It would be, how is the decision made? Is it an ongoing set of charities, single charity that the money's given to? How is that actually doled out? What is the actual implications of that?
It depends on where the store is. If we have an established bunch of groups that we're working with, we're always trying to maintain and nurture those relationships, as well as find new organizations that we think are doing an awesome job at something and could use a little bit of help. So at the store level, we talk about it as a team. Or team members will bring different organizations to our attention to say, hey, like, let's check out what these folks are doing and let's help them out with a grant. And then we do some other stuff at the store level as well, which is providing clothing donations that groups can use to, like, auction off in a silent auction or raffle off to try and increase membership or awareness about something. And then we also host events in the store to help raise awareness about local initiatives that are occurring.
So, Corey, in addition to being store manager, you're also the event coordinator, if you will, as well. So tell us a little bit. So part of what the reason we're talking to you this week is because of Bike to Work Month. And so you guys are putting on a series of events. So why don't you tell us about what you've got planned?
Sure. So we support kind of the whole Bike Month. We do a lot of kind of outreach, and we do a lot of stuff on social media that kind of promote all the Bike to Work Month events throughout Toronto. So specifically, this year we brought back our bike powered blender. We do Bike Blender Mondays, so we kind of bring it outside, make some awesome smoothies try to get the commuters to come by and basically saying thanks for commuting to and from work. So we do those every Monday throughout June. And then kind of our one big event that we're doing in June is kind of focused around bike-friendly businesses in Toronto. So we're looking at doing a workshop that's going to bring together these businesses or other businesses that are kind of looking towards trying to create that bike culture within and just giving people ideas on how to go about doing that. So we've got a number of organizations, single participants as well, that can go back to their business or organization and kind of create a more bike-friendly culture within their business. That's going to be on the 11th, in a couple of days, actually. It's coming up pretty quick. But it's going to be great. We're going to try to create kind of like a toolbox that businesses or organizations can use to create this kind of a more bike-friendly business. And that stems from, you know, each employee, the business itself, and as well as advocating for cycling within the city. So that's kind of our hope for the workshop.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about greenwashing and how that relates. I know that's been involved in some of the language that you've been talking about. Sort of a part of your sustainable outlook is not to just to do good, but also to try and encourage people and to point out yourself where maybe claims are not genuine as well. Can you maybe talk about how that relates as far as a business sort of almost getting into an educational role?
Yeah, sure. Definitely, the idea of greenwashing is something that people mention for sure. And there are definitely folks that use words like sustainability and environmentally friendly and so on and so forth. That maybe they recycle the paper in their office, and that's about the only responsible, sustainable thing that they do in their business operations. And that's certainly We don't think that's acceptable. We think everybody could do a whole lot better than that. So we are definitely not perfect as a company ourselves, and we know that, and we speak about it openly wherever we have places to work on within our company to improve. So we honestly believe that influencing other businesses to change their practices as well, just letting them know that there's lots that they can do, way more than they even know that they can do. And that's usually why stuff doesn't happen, is they don't even know in the first place. So we like to share what we do, and what we do is allowing us to be successful as a business. So we don't see why other businesses can't also step up and increase the amount of sustainable or responsible decisions that they make, be it about their supply chain or any aspect of how they run their business.
When you're getting into issues like advocating things like Bike Week, and you're getting into areas where I think a lot of people would consider them social issues in a lot of contexts. I mean, I think they're not. I think they're issues of science. I mean, when we're talking about trying to prevent climate change and all sorts of other things. But in a very casual sense, most people would say that, you know, things like consumption or labeling of different types of foods that we've been talking about recently on the show, or biking is, you know, a public transit issue, trying to promote public transit over promoting cars. I mean, these are sort of very social discussions that happen, and sort of, was there any consideration, because you've integrated these ideas so thoroughly into your business plan or into the business model and how you carry it out, in that you're very outspoken about a lot of these issues and put up open to the public a lot of the information about your own business and how you're trying to improve, and maybe some of the advantages that you've done in some areas that you could still improve. Was there any sort of thought behind the idea of maybe turning some people away by stepping so heavily into the kind of social public discussion realm as opposed to just trying to sell a product?
Yeah, you bet. we feel very fortunate, I'm speaking on Corey's back as well, to be able to speak out about our beliefs, because we happen to work for a company that is completely aligned with our beliefs. So I think we're very lucky in that place. We believe that change needs to happen, and it needs to happen on a grand scale. So there's no sense in beating around the bush in some of these topics. We need to drive less cars in the city of Toronto, as well as other cities, and in general. We need to think about what we consume and really consider a trip in a car before we take it. We're not all perfect either. I own a car, and I will drive that 2 hours out of the city to go visit my family. Like, we're not perfect, but I consider every trip that I take in that car. That's just an example. So again, not being perfect, but we just want people to think before they blindly consume, which is something we're all used to and is something that is ingrained in society. And it's a really hard shift to make in people's minds. And we believe that it's part of our responsibility to try and get people thinking and at least asking questions. Whether they're questioning us or they start to question some of the decisions that they make, either way, they're asking questions, and that's a good way to move forward.
I think a lot of the events that we do here as well, I mean, we open it up to the public, and we hope that it opens up discussion. I mean, that's the main kind of focus of a lot of our events, is just to create that discussion. Whether we agree with it, with each other or not, there's a lot to learn from each other. So in that case, it's great to have these open discussions. Not always open, but that's what we try to do with everybody there.
Getting into that, getting into events and interacting with the public, is this a situation where you sort of have a conversation with people and would maybe change business practices if somebody had a criticism? I mean, that's one of the considerations, you know, we've had to think about here, is we're sort of starting to set out on our own a little bit as far as developing a network and doing things with the Green Majority brand, and one of the things you have to think about with that is sort of, what are the consequences of certain allegiances, and what are the, you know, consequences of all sorts of decisions. So, I mean, how does that relate if you have a customer that comes in and says, well, you know, I'm very glad that, you know, this is reduced water, but it's also, you know, made from conflict fabric, or, I mean, there's a million other things you could say. I guess, where do you draw a line on that? Where is there, you know, only so much that one group of people can do in that sort of context, when people do have criticisms of what you haven't yet done?
Oh, for sure. There will always be criticisms of what we haven't yet done, because there's still so much more to do. we're open to any of that criticism. We take it, we have a number of different ways that customers can provide feedback directly to our head office. We'll take messages and pass them along by email to the appropriate folks who make decisions, be it on fabric sourcing or the supply chain, any number of topics that come up. We don't have it right in every regard, and a lot of the great ideas are questions that we ask ourselves as a company and have created change come from our customers, come from our employees on the front lines who have ideas and want to share them or have questions and think that things could be done in a better way. So we're completely open to that for sure. And we have some great discussions with customers here in the store that bring all sorts of their points of view to our minds. And it's I don't know, I think that's one of the great things about working here personally.
Do you want to chime in on that, Corey?
Yeah, I think whenever somebody comes in and starts questioning any type of material, I mean the best thing and one of the only things we can do, at least for that customer, is to educate them as best as possible to make their decision, their choice, a little bit better, well informed. And going from that, if they can find something else, I mean, like Andrew said, the company and the store itself is always open to feedback. I mean, if the people aren't concerned about what companies are doing, companies in general, that change is not going to happen. It has to take every single person, every consumer, to make those choices, to make change. And so all we can do is give them as much information as possible, all that we have, and then they can make an informed decision on what would be best for them in their lifestyle.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we aren't out of time, but I want to thank you very much for speaking to us here today, Andrea Reeks and Corey Gould from Patagonia, Toronto. We do have listeners. This is a national show. We have listeners all across the country. If there's people not in Toronto, is there somewhere you want to direct them for information or perhaps other store locations? And then if you want to just say again the information about the event and how people can find you here if they are in Toronto.
You bet. In Toronto, we are located at 500 King Street West. So that is just north or on the north side of King, just west of Spadina. And we've got a really great social media network going. You can find us on Facebook at Patagonia Toronto, Instagram at Patagonia Toronto, and Twitter at Patagonia Toronto, but missing the middle O, if that makes sense. Make it difficult. We're stopped by the store. We'd love to see you.
And for the event throughout June, if you're in the area on the next few Mondays from 4 to 6, we'll have our bike blender outside right in front of our store. And stop by for a fresh fruit smoothie. And then our bike-friendly business workshop is on the 11th from 7 to 9. You can RSVP by calling the store or going on our Facebook page.
All right. Well, thank you very much both for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, thanks very much. That's it, guys. Nice and easy. I'm going to send you a link tomorrow with the actual show file after it gets uploaded. So that you Whoops, I thought I'd edited that. Apparently, I had not. Sloppy editing caught, unfortunately. That was my interview with Andrea Reeks and Corey Gould of Patagonia. We're going to go to a music break here in just a second. But, Kevin, I was listening to the end of the interview again. I'm very certain that what he was talking about was a bike-powered blender. That does sound what he's referring to.
They exist. I know that. I've seen them.
All right. So, yeah. Well, if you want to see one in person, you can go to, I believe she said, 500 King Street West on any Monday throughout June. We will be taking a music break. However, you're listening to The Green Majority. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. That was actually Future Fires by Blinker the Star, which is a Canadian band. As always, almost always our music is prepared by Amber Waves, as it was today, DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog. And it is almost always she does our music. Always is, regardless of whether or not she does our music, it is always Canadian content, though. 100% every show, and make sure of it. Even if it is just me typing the words Tragically Hip or Bare Naked Ladies into YouTube, it is always Canadian one way or another, because I am not a music aficionado, so I have to defer to other experts on that. Kevin, you've never actually suggested any music. I don't. If at any point you would like to suggest some of your own music, you are free to do so. 7 years now, eventually. It took me 7 years to offer you, but you are welcome to suggest movie, Kevin.
I'll give it some thought. Thanks.
All right. But it has to be Canadian.
Right.
Okay. Now, you came in today prepared with a couple of stories. I've got a whole bunch of stuff here about oceans. I want to just mention a quick announcement on behalf of our friends over at TVO, the Water Brothers, first there, and then we'll get into some of your news announcements. So in celebration of Saturday, June the 8th, which is World Oceans Day, our friends over there at the Water Brothers will be doing a full episode sneak preview of one of their episodes, which is entitled Plastic Ocean, and has to do with their sailing expedition across the Pacific with a team of scientists, activists, and students studying the buildup of plastic in the ocean. So the teaser is available now on YouTube, and there is also on the 8th, they will be able to watch the full episode as well. We will have links to that on the website afterwards, but I just told them they've been very supportive of us in the past, so I just wanted to make sure that we got that announcement out on their behalf as well. But Kevin, without further ado, you had come prepared today with a couple of ideas. Not all of them have to do with oceans, but we'll get to your stories later, and then we'll come back to talking about oceans a little bit. So go ahead.
Well, I think a couple of things jumped out at me this week. One in particular struck me as apropos, that a wheat farmer in Oregon discovered some genetically modified wheat growing in his field. And he discovered this, although this gives me chills in its own right, he discovered this because he was trying to clear out a patch of wheat, and he was doing this by spraying it with herbicide.
As you do.
Yeah. Why you wouldn't just cut it down, I don't know. But he chose to spray it with herbicide and discovered a patch of it that wouldn't die. And he sent this wheat off to be analyzed, and it turned out to be Monsanto's genetically modified Roundup Ready wheat, which is immune to Roundup, which was their whole business model at the beginning of this, was they would produce wheat that was immune to a certain herbicide, so you could spray your fields freely with this herbicide to kill everything but the crop you were growing. So, I mean, of course, no one ever assumed the laws of nature would ever kick in, and we would produce weeds resistant to that chemical as well, which is, of course, exactly what happened, making the entire project moot and stupid. And but the thing is with this Monsanto wheat is that it's a particular form that they discontinued research on 10 years ago, maybe even 12 years ago, at least 10 years ago. And they have no idea how it got into this man's field. They were under the impression that they had destroyed all of the research material that project had generated. And this of course there's countries now threatening not to buy wheat from Oregon because they don't want, there's countries that are vehemently opposed to genetically modified crops, and they're threatening to not buy any of Oregon's wheat, which would be bad because that's a staple export from Oregon, and it would rack up damages in the hundreds of millions of dollars in lost sales if they couldn't move their wheat to market. And all of this just so happens to occur while Monsanto is enjoying a moratorium on litigation thanks to the Senate of thanks to an anonymous rider slipped into an agricultural bill in the U.S. Senate that declares Monsanto is free from litigation for at least 6 months. And it just so happens that these hundreds of millions of dollars of damages are going to occur while they have this unconscionable, this complete and utter, I mean, they've subverted every principle of democracy and free market capitalism you could think of, which are, you know,
talk about a get out of jail free card.
Yeah, literally. I mean, these are the sacred pillars of American society, you know, and it's like, And so Monsanto might just skate on this. And it's like, meanwhile, they can't explain how it got there. Well, at what point this, you know, I've always described genetically modified organisms as genetic pollution, because once you release them into the environment, they do, these genes do get swapped with other plants and other organisms. They do, as is already, evidenced by the existence of Roundup Ready, weeds that have, you know, they've somehow absorbed the genes from the plants and they've become resistant to Roundup too. You know, the plants cross-pollinate. They affect the biology of the pollinators that visit the plants. There's no way to clean up a quote unquote spill. Once it gets out there, there's just no way to call it back. So I've always wondered why the onus has never been on Monsanto to keep track of its product. In a landmark Canadian case, Monsanto versus Schmeiser, who is a Canadian farmer who was utterly destroyed by the Monsanto legal process. They found Roundup Ready wheat growing on his property, and the way they found that out was really cute. What they would do is they would fly over his property and they would drop herbicide bombs on his crops and see if, and then fly back later to see if everything where they had dropped the little bomb had died. And they found a patch of his plants that didn't die, and it was growing along a road, essentially along a ditch where seed trucks drove past all the time. Lots of other farms around him were using Monsanto seeds. He wasn't. He got sued for illegally producing their patented crop, and the Supreme Court of Canada awarded Monsanto damages. And I'm like, what the? Are you kidding me? Why isn't the onus on Monsanto to keep their genetic pollution, you know, in a holding pen somewhere? Like, why isn't it on them to keep track of their genetic pollution? I don't know. I can't think of any other word for it. They're performing uncontrolled experiments with genes. We don't know the full outcome of these things. We have no idea how, you know, when a gene has its purpose only within a specific environment. And if you change the environment, you change the purpose of the gene. Like, you know, you can, like, you, I think I mentioned this before on the show, you might live quite comfortably with the genetic predisposition towards type 2 diabetes. And you might live a perfectly healthy life until you change your diet. And so you've had the gene, but it was until your environment changed and we put you in a new environment that we discovered, oh, you've got this susceptibility to insulin resistance that was triggered by a change in your diet. But at your old diet, you were fine. So again, you're taking genes, you're moving them not just from plant to plant, but now from fish to plants, from insects to plants. And so we're saying we don't know what the full effects of this are going to be. We really don't. And people who are much wiser than me, like David Suzuki, are dead set against this stuff. And yet somehow Monsanto isn't under any obligation to look after their product and make sure that it doesn't escape into the wild or to escape onto Percy Schmeiser's farm. And they wiped him out. They cleaned him out. They totally obliterated that man with damages and court costs.
And regarding the GMO issue, because I actually had a very interesting conversation with some informed people about this recently, and I think everybody at the table was able to share some information that I think was offered new information, if not a new perspective on the conversation. So it's one of those really great things where I think we're a bunch of people that at least to a degree know what they're talking about, sit around a table and all learn something, I think, from everybody. Mm-hmm. So I love it when that happens. So it was one of those great sort of conversations where I think everybody picked up something from somebody else on the issue. But one of the important things that was brought up as a counterpoint was saying, you know, well, there's two different types of GMOs. There's stuff where you are taking things that could never happen in nature. You're taking a gene out of a fish or whatever, right, and putting it into an apple or whatever. The sorts of things that just won't. It would never in a million years happen. Well, maybe in a million years, but within our sorts of time scales would never happen in nature. And then there's ones that are, and there's certain types of where, you know, we're sort of using this umbrella term GMO to talk about it, where really, and what this person was saying, and they are correct, but their intention was to say, well, you know, not all of it, you know, we shouldn't throw out, they were arguing against GMO labeling, not because they think GMOs are fine, but because they don't like the implications. Anyway, I won't rehash the whole conversation. But essentially what they were saying was, you know, people have this knee-jerk reaction to GMO, and we should educate people, if you know, if they're going to boycott it, that many GMOs, many crops that are quote-unquote GMO, are simply doing the exact same process that would happen, that you could achieve simply by crossbreeding them. You're just skipping four generations. You're just doing it faster. But the actual thing that's taking place is identical and is no more dangerous than just breeding it naturally. And I said, okay, fine. But that sort of sounds to me like... If all you're doing is skipping four generations, and we're talking about broccoli, you could potentially in a hothouse get out two generations in a year. So you're skipping, you know, 2 years worth of work, really. So that sounds to me like kind of making like a nuclear-powered ice cream cone maker, you know. And you say, okay, well, why have you gone to all of this incredible trouble and you've built this? You know, you now have a small nuclear facility with all of the issues that go along with that. And I'm sorry, what was the purpose? I said, well, it makes ice cream cones. I said, yeah, okay, well, we have ice cream cones. What is the advantage of your nuclear-powered ice cream cone maker? I said, well, it makes them in 4 seconds instead of 10 minutes. Like, really? Like, either it's not true, either there's something else going on, because I don't see any company possibly putting that much time and resource and energy into a slight time advantage. It can't possibly be worth it for them. So either that explanation is a lie, or it's just that there's no consequences to them. The companies are confident that there's no consequences that they will ever be held accountable to, and so they're just playing around in the sand with genetics and saying, you know, and if something goes wrong, it's kind of like, oops, well, good thing we have that, you know, Senate new bill saying that we can't be charged or litigated for anything. For I mean, it's basically a license to kill, because I don't get it. I don't get the point of what it is that they're even doing, if it is how it's being told to me. Well, because the cost and the benefit seem not just misaligned, but orders of magnitude.
So
out of alignment.
So you're right to point out there's a difference between intraspecies and interspecies genetic manipulation. And I made examples out of the fish and the insects as, you know, sort of transspecies genetic modification. So there is some intraspecies modifications that are essentially, like you say, you could argue that there are just quicker versions of the hybridization we've been doing with plants ever since agriculture started. But that's when you have to factor in Monsanto's business model, which is also responsible for bringing us the Terminator technology that doesn't allow seeds, that the plants produce sterile seeds, so that you have to go back. So even if you've done a benign sort of, you know, intraspecies modification to a plant that's just made it a little more drought resistant or something, and you've sold that in the third world, which luckily climate change is making more drought prone, and then you sell them that technology, then they have to keep coming back to you for the seeds. So the problem, even for what you might want to argue are the more benign the more benign genetic manipulations, you still have the issue of a food that's been patented and it is considered intellectual property of a certain company that ultimately might have in its plans control of the food supply. And, you know, I believe it's in India or Africa. Oh Lord, what a memory. I believe it's in India where, you know, thousands of farmers have been driven to commit suicide because they've gone utterly broke, not being able to save their seeds, and they've in utter destitution have committed suicide. If you Google Monsanto suicide Indian, you'll find all manner of articles. I believe the estimate was 200,000 farmers committed suicide because they got caught in this Terminator technology. So again, you know, even for the benign, you know, which again that's arguable, but you know, even for what you might want to argue are the benign manipulations, someone owns that patent, and that's still quite an amazing thing when you think about it. That you've patented a gene, that plant is someone's property now. They introduce Terminator technologies, which is just such a heinous concept to say I'm going to specifically engineer plants to produce sterile seeds, so you have to keep buying seeds from me. That makes them the control of the food supply, which
yeah.
is.
We could probably do a 10-part series on GMO. There's so many facets to it, and I think one of the issues, just before we move on here, because I want to take a music break and come back to wrap up the show, is just to identify that there are a lot of things I think in the common discourse. I think we could very easily agree on this. Is that I think from a variety of perspectives, both from the anti/no GMO/label GMO community, and from the people, we did an item a while ago where I played a clip from Michael Spector talking about basically saying anyone who's anti-GMO is foolish and a conspiracy theorist.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's enough minutiae on there. There's enough finer points. There's enough technical details that it's a very difficult subject to deal with quickly. Intrinsically. So I will say because there's no possible way to sort of wrap this segment up that other than to say that we have a commitment to come back and give this a proper treatment again, because I really would like to dig into some of those finer points. And I think that's where you lose a lot of people is on those finer points, because people have heard talking points and they have not sat down with the finer points.
We should, arrange an interview with Percy Schmeiser.
Let's do it. I've just elected you to do that. Anyway, without further ado, we're going to go to a music break here just for a minute, and then we'll come back to wrap up the show. You've been listening to The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kastner, and we've got Kevin Farmer here in the studio as well. We'll be right back.
You walk like I thought you'd walk, and you talk like I thought you'd talk. Broken glass, lips to ass, the stars up in the sky. I'm like that one about a priest who walks in a bar, orders a drink, and then finds God, and then finds God. All in savage company with a smile. Cruelty free, why heavens me, I never thought I'd see the day. Cruelty free, why heavens me, I never thought I'd see the day. I had it coming.
All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kastner. You're listening to The Green Majority. We've only got a few minutes here left, Kevin, but I just want to wrap up a couple of quick finer points. We got pulled off there on GMOs for a minute. Again, we will come back and talk about that some more. That's something I'm very, very interested in. But I just wanted to mention a couple more things about oceans with regards to World Ocean Day, which again is June the 8th, and you can go and check out some Water Brothers stuff on there. So one of the things we were talking about was talking about Gulf oil spill when it comes to oceans and how that's hard to predict sort of issue. And one of the things was with the most recent Gulf oil spills, there was a number of things that surprised them. And one of them was that due to some hurricane activity, they had actually been preparing for a massive beach and land cleanup that actually didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And that was partially due to wind forces. That was partially due to the temperature of the water. It was cool, and that actually kept it from spreading to a degree. But what that actually may have done is actually might have made it harder in some senses to clean up, because what will happen traditionally is when there's an oil spill near on water near land is that it all kind of comes rushing ashore and there's absolute devastation. But you've got it contained. And therefore, even though there's a lot to clean up and there's a lot of devastation from it, you can get it under control in a more sort of timely manner. What happened with this temperature issue with where it wasn't spreading as much and actually sort of stayed subwater and hadn't moved out was that now what has happened is, because there wasn't one sort of burst of the oil, is that now it's almost been like under a time release bubble, and it's been sort of slowly leaking out and continuing to sort of spread in the years since the oil spill. And so that's sort of another fast fact, was that oil spills don't go away just when the corporate media stops reporting them. I would guess would be the headline on that one. Another thing we were talking about was the world's largest dead zone, which is near the Stockholm Archipelago. That's talking about the eagle there. I'm just going from the National Geographic news as well. And there's overfishing is adding to algal blooms. Again, as we were mentioning, there's problems in the Baltic Sea. We've got man-made noise. So there's an interesting article on the National Geographic talking about sound, which is something that I was trying to find examples of things that I hadn't sort of that sort of don't think about very often. One of them was sound pollution, and was actually the issue how in the water a lot of organisms that use sound for location detection. Sonar is a very, very common adaption for sea life to find their way, especially when there's not as much light as available. We've got submarines, we've got international power cables, we've got international internet cables. Those are all, you know, people may think just because they have Wi-Fi doesn't mean the entire planet is hooked up to Wi-Fi. We do actually have physical cables running through the oceans, connecting every house and town and home and country to each other. There's power cables, there's undersea laboratories, there's strip mining in the oceans, there's all of this, even from the actual devastation of doing all of that construction. All of that stuff changes the electromagnetic balance. It changes the amount of drastically increases the amount of noise that's there, which actually basically, I mean, it's basically sort of like blinding a lot of the sea life as well. You know, what hasn't been fished, eaten, or fished and then thrown back as a half-dead fish because it was, as you said, bycatch, then we're sort of irradiating, electrocuting, and blinding the rest. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, no, it's just that noise is, I mean, it's a good point. It's not really well understood that it's noisy underwater, and marine creatures do make a lot of noise. If you were to just put a hydrophone in the water and listen, you'd be surprised by how much noise goes on. But the main proponent is that ship travel. There's just at any moment in time, there's just thousands upon thousands of ships plying the seas, and the noise from the propellers is loud. And it used to be the case that whales could communicate with each other over vast distances, and these signals are getting lost in the noise now. So it's one of those things where we're not 100% sure what the outcomes are, but it's worth noticing that we've made the oceans very noisy, and that a lot of marine creatures do depend on sound for various activities in their daily life.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that is all the time we have for. Just going to give my tech some direction here. Normally, we have one song we use for the intro and the outro. I'm going to get it to play track 6, which is just the strumming again. This is the basis from Alejandro Rivera's new theme song for us, which you will have heard at the top of the hour and will also be available on the website as well. So further ado, thank you very much for joining me today on video, although this may never make it to the public. We're just sort of using it to test out the cameras, but for joining me as well today, Kevin.
Sure. Thanks, Darren.
All right. And that's it. That's all we have for the Green Majority. Thanks very much, and you hear from us all next week.
To Broadway, remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang on 42nd Street that I will soon be there.
I'm Joe, host of The Best of Broadway. Every Tuesday from 2 to 4 p.m., we bring you the score of a Broadway musical as well as individual theatrical numbers. For the best in musical theater and theatrical music, join me and the gang on 42nd Street for The Best of Broadway, Tuesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
Sassy.
This week's episode, Trouble on Rock Hill.
Ain't nothing like running up and down Rock Hill.
Hey, let's move this rock.
Whoa! Sassy, Johnny's stuck under that rock. Yeah, girl, go tell Mr. Gunderson to bring his truck. You'll tell him, but only after you dispel a stereotype associated with shelter pets? shelter pets come with lots of initial veterinary costs?
It's dusty under here.
But in reality, most shelter pets have been vaccinated, neutered, and microchipped in case they get lost.
My pants ripped.
Sassy, Johnny needs help. What Johnny really needs is more discipline and better parental supervision. You use big words, Sassy.
Still under the rock.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
It's that time of year. Time to register at Henry Ford Community College for the 2013 fall semester. Most of the classes that you will take at Henry Ford Community College will transfer to major four-year institutions in the area. Also, HFCC has some of the lowest tuition rates around. First-time students can go to the Welcome Center on campus. Call 800-585-HFCC or go to the web at www.hfcc.edu for more information. Fall semester starts August 22nd, so register today to get the best choice for classes. See you there.
This is Dr. Wally B. from Cat Daddy in the 1320s, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, making waves.
Dig deeper. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area on the new WHFR Journal every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. and anytime as a podcast from WHFR.fm. Join our WHFR news team as we dig deeper, making waves.
WHFR Dearborn. Good morning, good afternoon. Welcome to the Best of Broadway. I'm Joe, your host, for the next 2 hours. And we're going to start off this first hour with the play of a Flower Drum Song by Rodgers and Hammerstein, music by Richard Rodgers, lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein, book by Oscar Hammerstein II and Joseph Fields, based on a novel by a Chinese-American author named C.Y. Lee. And he explored the conflicts between the first generation of Chinese immigrants living in San Francisco and their American-born children. The storyline, I'm Joe, your host, and glad to have you with us. The opening of Flower Drum Song finds the household of Wang Chi Yang faced with problems of adjustment. Mr. Wang is a Chinese gentleman of the old school. His son, Wang Ta, is caught between Chinese tradition and American ways. His second son, Wang San, is entirely Americanized. And his sister-in-law, Madame Liang, is an enthusiastic candidate for